From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Mark, Eric, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
Don, thank you
for having us.
Thanks. So, Paris, let's start there.
All right. Well, first thing we have to say is that our sympathies and our concerns and prayers are, of course, with the French people and the citizens of so many other countries, from Chile to Mexico to the United States to Britain, that died in the tragedy early this weekend in the attacks in Paris. We're going to spend probably the next hour criticizing, critiquing French foreign policy, and it's, as WikiLeaks put it, tweeting earlier, well, I guess it was yesterday, the entirely predictable events due to France's interference supporting extremists in Syria and in Libya. That said, nothing justifies what happened. It doesn't justify it in Paris. It doesn't justify the attacks, the suicide attacks in Beirut,
right,
which most of the world's, at least the West press, has ignored. It doesn't justify the suicide attacks a day earlier in Baghdad. It doesn't justify the bombing of a girls' school by moderate West-backed rebels in Latakia, the daily attacks in Syria. It must be said that the French people tragically have had to sip from the same cup that the bitter cup that the people of Damascus have had to drink from for the last 4 years now. So our sympathies go with the families, those who have lost their lives. But our job here is not to hold hands and issue Hallmark platitudes, but to discuss causes, raise understanding, and to suggest solutions.
Right. I agree with that completely.
This is a big step for, if we go with the assumption that this is ISIS, and that is an assumption, certainly the French government has been quick to place that blame. They have also evidently, through several channels, claimed responsibility for it. My biggest argument in favor of that is that no one else has claimed responsibility for it,
right,
and it is a terrorist act. So bar any other evidence of states having a role in this, which must remain in the realm of conspiracy theory for the moment, we'll go with the working assumption that it was ISIS. And if it was ISIS, it is crossing the Rubicon.
I just wanted to jump in real quick in the interest of us having a back and forth, as I know we every week say we're going to, and then
yes,
every week,
then
every week Mark and I just go off on our monologues. But I just want to note before we jump into the ISIS question, this issue of justification I think is important, because in fact I appreciate that Mark opened the show and his comments by talking about our sympathies being with French people. And the fact that it doesn't justify, and nothing justifies any of the attacks, whether it's Paris or Beirut or Damascus or whatever. Of course, all of that is important. But I think it's important to note that here in the West, at least, the media does justify certain attacks while claiming that others are unjustifiable. So, for instance, in Paris, the attacks are considered unjustifiable, wanton acts of carnage, inhuman barbarism, etc., etc., etc. Of course, it is that. However, if you were to read the headlines of the bombing in Beirut, for example, they don't note anything about barbarism or anything like that. The headlines read something to the effect of, and I'm mostly quoting here, something to the effect of twin suicide bombs attack Hezbollah stronghold.
Hezbollah bastion.
Yeah, yeah, bastion, and,
bastion.
And stronghold, yes. And things like this. Now, to me, I think that there is a not so subtle implication there, and the implication is a justification. In other words, yes, this is horrific. Yes, people have been blown to pieces, children killed, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, this was a stronghold of a terrorist organization. Therefore, it's justified. So I think that this is something that really needs to be brought out into the light of day. What does justification actually look like?
Let's add the Russian airplane too. I mean, the same story there.
Same thing. Exactly. So, you know, within an hour or two of the Russian airplane being downed, once people started bringing up the ISIS question, it was inevitably not that this was an act of barbarism and inhuman, you know, terrorism, but rather that this was blowback from Russia's intervention in Syria, Russia's engagement with the Syrian government, etc. So there, when we talk about justification,
despite the fact that it was ISIS whom the West is also attacking,
So I think that this is a very real issue. What does justifying terrorism look like, and how does the media actually do that? Because sometimes it's somewhat subtle, and it might be lost on some people.
Well, we need a definition of terms.
Not all victims of terrorism are equal.
Let's talk about what blowback means. That's really a bastardization of the term blowback to apply it to the Russians. That would be retribution, not blowback. The Russians did not empower ISIS. They didn't arm them. They didn't fund them. They didn't buy their oil. They didn't buy their antiquities.
Yes. I mean, and the whole stew that has led to the emergence of ISIS and has, because it would be incorrect to say that the French government has directly armed ISIS. No, they've done it indirectly. They've armed and funded what they call moderate rebels, these 31 flavors of jihad running around Syria, conducting attacks in Syria daily, reminiscent of what happened in Paris this week. The Syrians have had to endure it for four long years now. To condemn one and not the other is inhuman, or it is dehumanizing. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has said before, this game of dividing up some terrorists as good terrorists and other terrorists as bad terrorists, it's what has led us to exactly this point. And I think I have a quote here from Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, who said that terrorism is not a winning card that you can play when it suits you and stick back in your pocket when it doesn't. Yeah. Terrorism is like a scorpion. It stings you when you least expect it. Yep. And that's exactly what we saw.
Yep. I'm going to go back to a definition of terms. Blowback is, for example, when in 1979 you grab a bunch of medieval aristocrats in Afghanistan and arm and train them and give them rocket launchers and teach them insurgency techniques and fund them and place them in various places afterwards. And then in 2001, the very same people crash planes into your buildings. That's blowback.
Yeah, and I think that it's also important to remember too that when we're talking about the way in which this has all happened and the way in which France is implicated in this, there's something that is lost, I think, oftentimes in the narrative. I mentioned it repeatedly on RT, on Press TV, and any other chance that I got. Specifically, the fact that any fighters in Syria who may, you know, veterans of the war in Syria who would conduct terrorist actions in France undoubtedly have some kind of connection to France. Now, we don't know what that connection is. We do know, documented by the New York Times, the Washington Post, BBC, and many others, that French intelligence has been on the ground in Syria since at least 2011. I mean, it's not a secret. Anybody who knows how to do a Google search can find this information. While Mark was talking, I have the headline right here. BBC, 10th of September, 2012. Syria defector Manaf Klaas hints at French intelligence aid. Talks about in the article, French intelligence on the ground in Syria providing arms and providing funds and providing helping people to get in and out of Syria. I mean, this is no secret what the French are doing on the ground there, just as what the U.S. and the British have been doing on the ground as well. And I think we should also assume Israeli Mossad for sure. So when we're talking about France's involvement in Syria, I think it's unfair to say that France is only, you know, and I know Mark wasn't implying this, he was saying specific to ISIS, but it's unfair to say that France is only indirectly involved on the ground. France is directly involved and have been from the very beginning. Not only that, France is the former colonial power in a lot of places, in North Africa, and in the Middle East, Syria, Lebanon particularly. So there's a very clear and obvious reason why you would have fighters who are fleeing the battlefield, who don't want to get their, you know, blown up by Russian bombs or whomever, who are fleeing into Europe, end up in France. So not only is this coming back on the French, I think, and it's entirely predictable, I think that in many ways the French intelligence services, who are doing a disservice to the French people, in many ways have brought this on France.
Well, and then let's go back to February 24th, 2011, the Pakistan Observer, which reported U.S., U.K., and French troops landed in Benghazi in Libya, which is at the beginning of the entire trouble there. So it shows...
And who are they working with?
They were working with exactly these same terrorist groups that overran Libya and have been active in Syria since almost that same period of time.
Let's talk about what they call foreign fighters. What they mean by that is jihadists who travel from other countries to Syria to wage jihad against the Syrian people. And according to the Washington Post, as of January, so it's quite a bit out of date, we can expect the numbers a little higher than this, more than 10,000 fighters, jihadists from Europe, just from EU alone, have traveled to Syria. The most out of continental Europe, out of Europe, 1,200 of them, again only from January, come from France, and the French government, like most of the governments of Europe, up until maybe the last year, have done nothing to dissuade or stop these people from going to Syria. The only question on their minds was, well, if they come back, what? They might do some of what they were doing in Syria at home. And this is exactly, all indications that, as with the earlier Charlie Hebdo attack, is that some of these people were involved in Syria. And they have indeed come home. And it would be really facetious of the French government to, claim that they don't have a responsibility in what happened because of this. I found an interesting poll. I want you guys to tell me what you think of this. Rossiya Sivonia, the Russian state news agency, commissioned a poll by the reputable ICM, who conducted a poll in France a year ago, and the other European countries, of support for ISIS. And the results of the poll were that some 15-16% of the French population supports ISIS, and that among 18 to 24-year-olds, that number jumps to 24%, I believe.
Ouch.
Now, I have serious problems with that poll, because that's almost, that's at least, if not more, than the entire Muslim population of France, which is somewhere between 10 and 15% by best estimates. France doesn't like census taking of the number of Muslims because of their politically correct ideology of multiculturalism, etc. But let's assume it's just a fraction of that. Let's just, because it's one of the questions. The methodology of this poll was found to be good. The question was, do people even know a year ago what ISIS was, when ISIL, it was phrased as Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Do they even know what it is when they're answering the question?
I just want to interject if I could. Also, I haven't seen that poll. I don't know. But polls can also be very deceptive. And the phrasing of a poll, in other words, what does support mean? If you look in the United States, for instance, they do every single day on the news, they have various polls about Hillary Clinton and the Republicans and this or that. And, you know, Fox News, the poll that they run, they're deceptively worded to make it look like there's far more support for some of these candidates that have no support. You know, this is standard tactics as far as polling goes. So I would ask the basic question of, what does it mean when they say support for ISIS? I mean, you know, I think that that's I don't know. I'd have to see the poll before I made any conclusions. But I think that oftentimes support can be let's say an ambiguous word.
Well, let's
I assume it's just a fraction of that myself. I assume that there's some problems with the poll. But even a fraction of the populations of Europe supporting ISIS in whatever form should terrify the people responsible for security in the EU. Yeah. There's just numbers out of the French government last night. They say that the French intelligence is tracking 2,000 people in France that it suspects of being jihadists, that it regards as jihadists, and another 4,000 to 5,000 that are in immediate danger of radicalization.
Yeah. I mean, look at the United States. There was 18 people, supposedly, that did 9/11. 18 out of, say, 350 million, you're talking about 1 in 20 million. That's all it takes to do something like that. If you're talking about percents, 1, 2, 3, 4% of support, whatever it is, you know, there's a potential serious problem there.
Yeah, but again, I would say that What does support mean? I mean, if you ask an 18-year-old kid who's disillusioned about, you know, being unemployed and having little prospects for a future, does he support some, you know, murderous mercenary army that is targeting white people? He might support it, you know, emotionally and, you know, philosophically. I don't think that necessarily means that he's necessarily going to, you know, don the all black and pull out an AK-47. You know what I mean? Great. So I think we have to be somewhat cautious about what the word support actually means. I mean, there are a lot of people who support a lot of causes that they won't get off the couch for.
Yeah, that's true. And
you know, I think if anyone gives any amount of support to ISIS, I think it's an extremely dangerous. ISIS is an ideology. It is a politics. Right. It is a religion. It is an economics. It is a society. I think if you really want to understand ISIS, and I think part of the problem with our governments, our security institutions at this point, and this is frankly admitted by people in the U.S. security establishment, we don't know what motivates people to ISIS. We don't even understand what ISIS is. I would advise everyone to go to March in the Atlantic. There is an article by Graham Wood, a long form, very, I think, very necessary reading called What ISIS Really Wants. And you don't have to agree with everything in this article. I certainly don't. You read the article and then read the critiques of the article, but it's really started a very heated debate on Western scholars of ISIS and what is going on there. And frankly, what he depicts in that article is frightening.
Well, let me say this, okay? I hear everything that's being said, but I'm also a little bit hesitant to ascribe, let's say, dangerous motives to somebody who expresses some sympathies for ISIS. ISIS is literally the scum of the earth. I mean, this is the worst form of barbarism, inhuman, etc. It deserves all condemnation. So don't paint me as anybody who wants anything other than their total destruction. What I am saying, though, is, 50, 60 years ago, people stood up in front of the U.S. Congress and talked about the looming danger of communist agents all throughout the United States. There were thousands of communists who expressed sympathy for the Soviet Union and for communism who support it, etc. Now, did they represent a mortal threat to the United States? Well, if you listen to Senator McCarthy, they did. But I think in retrospect, that's not only overblown, I think it's somewhat illusory. Right. And so I'm simply cautioning people against thinking that someone who expresses quote-unquote support for that ideology, someone who may be disaffected, disenchanted, maybe unstable, who knows, it necessarily represents a threat to the country in which they reside. I don't necessarily buy that.
Let's take context.
The difference between the two of them there is that, of course, the communists didn't run rampage through Western capitals.
Agreed.
With gunfights and suicide bombs.
Agreed. But if you listen, I agree. But if you listen to Senator McCarthy at the time, you think that they were about to. That's all I'm saying.
Let's look at this in the political context of Europe.
But yes,
at
I
the
agree
moment,
with you, Mark.
Because we've got, regardless of what it actually represents, there's the perception of what it represents.
That's
and that
true.
Happens within the context of the polarization of various European societies, both outside of the recent refugee crisis, quote unquote, and also with it. Did we just lose you guys?
No,
I think Mark
okay,
sent
sort
us
of bloop.
Yep.
And also, of course, the polarization is taking place over economic issues, primarily, particularly austerity and some of the changes on the ground in the political configuration in Europe. You've got a polarization of politics with the right rallying somewhat yes. against austerity, but now over immigration, and the left rallying over austerity, particularly seeing forward motion in Portugal this past week, a resurgence of that in Greece with Syriza supporting the general strike in Greece, and of course the Spanish elections looming.
Yeah, the polarization issue is huge, and I think that it's something that really needs to be addressed because, of course, there's two ways that you'll have a right-wing, conservative, whatever, nationalist reaction here. On the one hand, obviously, in France, this is going to benefit significantly Marine Le Pen and the Front National. They're going to undoubtedly capitalize on this. It'll strengthen their right flank. It'll strengthen their position even among quote unquote moderates and centrists in France, who are I think obviously justifiably mortified by what's happened. At the same time, this is also going to bolster the fascist right in Europe, and I think that is clear. Whether you're talking Golden Dawn in Greece, whether you're talking Nazis in Ukraine, or whether you're talking the Hitler worshippers of former Soviet republics in the Eastern European space, be it Hungary or what have you. So I think that is a phenomenon that is certainly going to be strengthened, and Le Pen is probably benefiting from this more than anybody. I'm not suggesting anything nefarious about that, other than to say that Le Pen is going to be front and center in a debate that is going to swing far to the right, and she's going to be, let's say, seen as a voice of reason, which, in my opinion, is a very negative development.
Yeah. Mark?
I'll be glad to see Le Pen put forward center stage. And I think in order for a real political change in France, I don't see any alternative to shake up the status quo than a Le Pen presidency. So I'll agree to not agree with every one of her domestic policies, but
my point is that I think it's somewhat an illusion that she really shakes things up in a fundamental way. She talked about pulling France out of NATO. I'd like to see her try. She's talked about, you know, pulling France out of the European Union. I'd like to see her try. I think that these things are hollow campaign promises, and once she's in office, the major energy will be directed towards Islamophobia, xenophobia, and other negative reactionary policies.
I think possibly, but I'd like to see her try.
I think she's been given the space to walk, you know, to walk back from those positions. Before,
of course, she has, and she will.
Look. Ideologically, the right, of course, is not opposed to austerity. That's a program of the right, even of the yes. liberal right. Ideologically, of course, nationalism is one of the fundamental organizing principles. However, the European Union is itself a structure of the right, not of the local nationalists, but of European imperialism. And so, there's a contradiction there. You can rally the troops with it, but you really can't deliver because the right is, of course, in service to capital. And those are programs of capital. Walk from it.
I just want to interject, though, where I slightly disagree with you, Don, is that the European Union is a structure of both the neoliberal right and the neoliberal left. You know, the liberal neoliberal whatever, you know, spectrum shifts from the center right to the center left, and all of these imperialists of whatever their social inclinations may be fit in there, whether they're liberals or conservatives. So
I think name calling and attribution of one particular policy as right or left is not only outdated. I think it's deconstructed. It's
Well, I don't think that it's entirely not useful, because I do think that it still has some relevance depending on context. I just mean within the context of trying to define and describe the ruling class that that controls something like the European Union, it's certainly not a right-wing phenomenon. It's more of a liberal left imperialist to conservative right imperialist
centrist, neoliberal, technocratic,
postmodern liberal. But certainly, if we're describing Nazis in Ukraine, or if we're describing, you know, the radical right wing fascists of Hungary or what have you, I mean, certainly in those regards, we can certainly still use those terms.
We've got a bastardization of the language that's taken place, particularly in the last 50 years or so in the West, accelerating, say, in the last 25. But you can go back even to the late 20s, early 30s, and remember that the Party of the Hard Right, the Nazi Party, of course, styled itself as a socialist party.
Yes,
and
that's
bastardized
correct.
The term even then. Yeah. But socialists are not, actual
Good
socialists
point.
Are not
Good
of
point.
The right.
That's absolutely right, and again, I mean, it's one of the things that I think is illustrates the political acumen of Hitler and the Nazis, was they understood the importance of appropriating the word socialism and infusing it into their clearly and unmistakably reactionary right-wing ideology, and I think it was certainly not lost on the communists of the day what they were doing, but for a lot of people in the middle, you know, social democrats, bourgeois liberals, and so forth, I think there were many people who were somewhat enamored of Hitler solely by the appropriation of the word socialism.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you could look at that even with people describing what Bernie Sanders means when he calls himself a socialist. To me, a socialist
that's
is someone...
That's a topic for another day.
A socialist to me is someone
now.
Who...
local community radio broadcaster compares Sanders to Hitler.
Not exactly. But on that score, because here we go. We've got we've got essentially the actual definition of socialism that I use, and that socialists generally used historically, is ownership of the means of production by the workers.
Yeah.
And that ain't what they say Sanders is talking about at all, and yet they call him a democratic socialist, which I guess means somebody else other than the workers owns the means of production.
Well, but you know what?
Socialism by American standards.
Well,
is,
and also I would say
is essentially a European liberal. You know.
Yeah, right, I was going to say that when he says social democrat, I mean there is a long tradition of people who call themselves social democrats who are merely the left of capitalism. Right. I mean there's a long history of that. All of the so-called socialists who supported World War I, a lot of the socialists of the 1920s and 30s. I mean there's a lot of people who could fall into that category of quote-unquote social democrats who were certainly in favor of anything but socialism.
Right. I mean, I guess when they started using the term social democrat, they were talking about social policy and not economic policy.
Well, and also, remember, if you read Lenin, I mean, Lenin at the time in 1900, when he's writing like What Is to Be Done, for instance, in his Iskra period, I mean, he talks about the revolutionaries as social democrats. But at the time, that was just the word that they used to describe socialists, you know, before they had the other terminology. But by the 1920s, social democrat meant something distinctly different from the communist revolutionary.
Because economic activity was lifted out of the definition of social activity. That's what that was at the essence of it.
Right. Wow, that was a tangent.
I'm going to swing us back around.
Go ahead.
The parents and the attacks. Yeah. All right, so ISIS. Let's go with the working assumption that this attacks, the downing of the Russian airliner in Egypt, A321, the attacks in Beirut, Baghdad, Latakia. Let's assume that this is ISIS. This has been described, I think, very correctly in the pages of the New York Times as ISIS crossing the Rubicon. Up till now, ISIS, which did emerge out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, transplanted to Syria and the chaos of the civil war and jihad there. But they have been primarily concerned, very interestingly, very divergently from their Al-Qaeda, sometimes allies, sometimes foes, as being principally involved about territory, about taking and holding a caliphate and the very religious and political implications for Salafism of a caliphate versus an underground terrorist group or dictator-ruled Arabic states that pay lip service to Salafism. So this is them, as it were, moving from concentrating on holding ground and building their caliphate to what Salafists, jihadists like to refer to as the far enemy, the West and other countries outside of the Islamic immediate Islamic world or their immediate area of concern. And that is a real game changer for ISIS. And I would like to propose that the reason that they're doing, we should talk about why, that they're doing this is to lure the West into a large ground invasion of Syria and Iraq, because that would fulfill their apocalyptic vision, which is extremely important by all accounts to their particular brand of Salafist poison, of a final battle between the forces of the caliphate and Rome, which is in modern days depicted as the West, in northern Syria, outside of Aleppo. The Quran's very specific about identifying even to the place and so on. So this is what they're doing. This is why they're doing it, is because they have been stagnating in terms of territorial expansion, reaching the limits of the power vacuum that they can expand to in Iraq and Syria. So they're going global, as it were, and I think it's very interesting.
I think that I want to shift at least my portion of this discussion here a little bit back to Paris, because I think that while everyone is afraid of being tarred and feathered with the term conspiracy theorist, I think that there is a very important series of questions that has to be asked. Number one, when I was on Press TV a couple of hours after this all happened, I was on with Pepe Escobar, who I love tremendously and who's great and everything. And anyway, Pepe was talking about these accounts that he was going through because he's very familiar with that, with the neighborhood where the restaurant where the people were murdered is in the neighborhood that he lives in, etc. And he was talking about accounts from two eyewitnesses who described the person coming in with the AK-47 dressed in all black, shooting professionally, looking like a pro, not like some drug-crazed ISIS, you know, meth head or whatever, which is how a lot of people have described these people doing the actions in Syria when they murder children, when they put families on their knees and put bullets in the back of their heads. Oftentimes they're described as drug-crazed and so forth. This was described as some kind of a, you know, smooth operator, right? And this person had no suicide vest. There was no indication that this person had explosives strapped to them of any kind, and walked in, shot a bunch of people, walked out, and that was it. Now, yeah. I have some questions about that because in my mind, Paris, maybe not to the extent of, you know, Beijing or even New York or London, maybe, but I think that Paris is probably on par with some of the world's cities as far as leading in terms of surveillance cameras, closed circuit television, and so forth. Now, between the surveillance apparatus, between the fact that the streets were filled with cops because of a number of high-profile events, including the France-Germany match, including the fact that it was a Friday night. I have a very real question as to how this person walked in, pulled out a gun, shot all these people, walked out, and is not apprehended. Now, that to me smells of at least something that deserves to be questioned. Now, if people don't want to say, you know, conspiracy theory, whatever, that's fine. I don't care about that so much. I would be very interested to know how this exactly happened, because if you read the mainstream accounts, as I did with New York Times this morning, none of that is in the account. If you were to read what they write about it, it's basically, you know, seven people, each of them with suicide vests, and they're all dead, right? There is no real mention of how this was actually pulled off, what the people on the ground are saying actually happened. Now, again, this happens every time we have an incident like this. There are all of the usual suspects come out saying it was staged, saying, you know, no one was really killed. They're all crisis actors, whatever. Forget all of that. All I'm suggesting is there are some very, I think, pressing and urgent questions to be asked about how this was done and who would have done it. Because if this was as coordinated as they describe, and if this was done under the nose of the intelligence community and the law enforcement people on the ground, then either this is yet again a monumental failure of epic proportions, or perhaps something that involves other players that we don't yet know.
Right. And you've got the, you know, who benefits question to raise.
But of course,
before we dive into it.
Exactly.
Before we dive into that.
Yeah, I think there's some good questions there. I mean, this was obviously an extremely professional, well-planned attack. There were at least three teams. I'm going to tell you right now that there were far more than eight people involved.
Of course. Sure. Yeah.
Right? I mean, not only in the planning and logistics of it, but even in the operation of it. They had attacks on seven locations.
Yeah.
So obviously there's still some people running around who were involved in that. If not in France, maybe they've already, you know, we've got open borders. They could be anywhere by now. But I suspect that there's still cells, you know, operating in there. I don't think that we have to immediately exclude ISIS. They are a quasi-state with a lot of resources.
Oh, I don't at all. Yeah.
Most of their commanders are Ba'athist generals according to their own admission, while they were being tortured by U.S. occupation forces, locked up with Salafists, found Islam, this extreme Salafist form of Islam. So they have this very strange mix of apocalyptic, you know, medieval ideology with pragmatic skills and so on. And, you know, they have held large portions of Iraq and Syria, spread in with affiliates into Libya, Sinai Peninsula, Afghanistan. You know, they've got capability at this point.
Yeah.
But hold on, go ahead. I would buttress you. There was a little point that hasn't been brought up. Politico Europe yesterday, early in the hours after the attack, made a little note, a tweet, in their live blog. I posted it on my social media. Anyone can check it there. I can provide it. 2 months ago, French authorities arrested a suspect that allegedly planned an attack on a concert hall. They knew this was going to happen. They had arrested someone who was, he says, recruited for an attack on a concert hall this week.
Yeah.
Now, they may not know what concert hall, but this is an incredible incompetence of... It was not even an intelligence failure, because obviously they had the intelligence, of failing to politically act on that intelligence, or they let it happen.
Right.
And then we have the question, of course, of passports. Every time a terrorist dies, evidently passports fall from heaven like manna onto the ground around them in perfect condition to be read, whether they blow themselves up or they get toasted in the the World Trade Towers.
Yeah, well, 102-story building or whatever, 110-story building catches fire so hot that it collapses, and yet a passport drops out of the sky.
Well, and look, the passport, I'm not going to touch the 9/11 passport thing, because that's silly and obviously
a plant of some kind.
But I do think that people are sort of lampooning this the passport thing in Paris. I don't know. I mean, is it so unreasonable if you think that you're going to carry out an action and immediately flee the country and try to make it back to the Middle East that you would have your passport? It's possible, I suppose. You know what I mean? Like, I have no idea, but certainly,
they intended to blow themselves up.
Well, but that's not a foregone conclusion, because
suicide belts. We can just make that a conclusion.
Or they thought that they were being part of a larger operation and that they were going to escape. And I think that a lot of people get duped. I think that people who carry out suicide bombings are duped by whoever their handlers are into believing that this is, you know, this is a show, this is a drill, this is whatever. And I'm going to make it out of here, and I'm going to be home in time for dinner. You know what I mean? So who knows exactly?
Really? Do you think that?
I think some people, yeah, absolutely. I think that some people think that they're going to get paid to be part of an operation. They're going to carry this out. They're going to go home and see their families. You know, I do think that it's up in the air exactly what the mentality was, how this whole thing played out. But I do think that a lot of these guys are duped into it. There is a story that's been carried, actually a number of them, but one specifically that documented, I think it was Glenn Greenwald in The Intercept, but a few others as well, about these plots that are hatched by the FBI, in which they entrap these people. A lot of them are mentally, let's say, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. They're recruited into carrying out an action to blow up some symbolic, you know, thing in Portland, Oregon, or in Washington, D.C., or whatever, just so that the FBI can then step in at the last minute and say they foiled the plot. This has happened repeatedly, and I think it was The Intercept story that documented that something like 90% of the plots that have been foiled by the FBI have been hatched by the FBI.
Yeah.
So, they're hatched only for the purposes of being foiled. Now, I think that this is also an avenue for investigation. The extent to which these types of terrorist plots are oftentimes hatched by intelligence agencies for the purposes of foiling them.
All right, there's something first. I just want to make a quick reference to the fact that, you know, you mentioned the ISIS people on the ground in Iraq and Syria have been described by many people as being, you know, all drugged out, a lot of the, you know, foot soldiers.
That's what the eyewitnesses say. Yeah,
and that's interesting, because if you go back to what Gaddafi said at the very beginning of the invasion of Libya by these very same troops, that's what he had said was going on, and everyone laughed at the time. But it appears that that was actually true as well.
Well, and actually, there was a story that came out. I'm not trying to hog the mic. I'll give it to Mark in a second. There was a story that came out a few months ago, I think now, where I think it was a Saudi who was arrested for importing like tons of methamphetamines and various other drugs that were intended to go to the battlefield in Syria. Now,
that was in Jordan.
Okay,
a Saudi prince. Yes,
thank you. Yes,
with a plane full of several tons worth of drugs that, yes, are the drug of choice, not just of the ISIS, but just about everyone.
Yeah, now
in Syria,
there's a whole history,
including the Syrian Arab Army. Actually,
there's a whole history of militaries using methamphetamines to keep their soldiers up. Look,
yes.
that goes back to World War II. So nobody should be blown away by that. But it does sort of bolster the accounts of people who have survived these ISIS massacres, who say that the people who are shooting babies in the head are completely drugged out of their minds. So again, I mean, if that guy, if we're to believe the account of the guy who calmly and coolly walks into that restaurant, starts popping innocent people in the head and in the chest and walks out, and he was not a drug crazed lunatic, again, I have very serious questions about this narrative.
I have no problem. I agree with you completely that there is no doubt in my mind that ISIS does indeed have hordes of peons that are what you describe, drug crazed idiots. But at this point, I think we have to recognize that they also have serious capabilities.
Yeah,
and that they have a very powerful, very well thought through and very elaborate ideology that supports what they're doing. And when we say ISIS, this also extends, of course, to Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, Jihad al-Sham, the Jaish al-Fatah, the Islamic Army of Conquest, in various forms and things. Right. But these people have been in a very hellish war for 4 years now, and there's quite a number of quite a lot of experience and quite a lot of professionalism gained by those who have survived some length of time on the battlefield.
Well, let me ask
Okay, hang on a second, because if you're talking about the officer class, many of those have actually been involved in either hard or soft battle for 25 years since the original U.S. invasion of Iraq in 1990-91.
Yeah. Mark, that's right. I mean, you're 100% right, Don. I want to ask Mark a question, I'll make a statement and ask Mark a question. You know, Walter Lippmann, famous, journalist, author, theorist, propaganda, he wrote in the early 20th century in his book Public Opinion about – he defined what we now call the stereotype, and he described it as the image we see in our mind's eye. In other words, a socially constructed image. And that these things can be manipulated. Now, would you agree that quote unquote ISIS is now essentially a brand name and a stereotyped image? In other words, somebody who is, dressed, clad in all black with military style weapons and killing innocent people could now be described as ISIS understanding of who might be dressed in that black.
You've got a principal agent issue here, okay? There's not a corporate filing for ISIS and franchise agreements written between them that say you are authorized to use the name ISIS. And so when you have a public statement from ISIS, quote unquote, or ISIS in Syria or ISIS in Paris or whatever, the actual connection to the group that is holding ground in certain parts of Iraq and Syria, you know, that there's not necessarily a chain automatically involved because someone says there is.
That's right. Yeah, I agree.
No, there are. First of all, I agree with you. Right. This the image imago, if we want to, of ISIS is something and et cetera, Al-Qaeda, this has been done before, is something that is used both by Western governments and intelligence agencies, the press, and also by them themselves. But I mean, one can easily delve into, you know, the subcultures of their very effective online, you know, they're often called the fanboys radicalization, to see that, you know, there's more there than just that, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with you on that point, no doubt about it. But again, I mean, I don't think that it's a fanboy who walks into a cafe and starts killing innocent people. I think that that takes a pro, and I think that we should be asking what kind of pro, where did this pro come from, and why now, why there? I mean, there's a lot. Yeah. All I'm saying is there's a lot of questions that nobody wants to ask because they're afraid of being tarred and feathered as a conspiracy theorist.
Well, and there's this aspect.
I would be one of those.
There's this aspect to it, too.
I'll be perfectly frank there. I'm wary myself of stepping into conspiracy theory.
Me too.
It's too early.
There
anyway.
Are Occam's razors solutions available.
Yeah, right. Agreed. I would only my only counter argument to that is that these are exactly the kinds of questions that need to be asked by people who. Of their own choosing, stand outside of the controlled corporate Western media system. If you're outside of that system, you have the freedom to ask these questions without necessarily immediately jumping to the lunacy of an Alex Jones and that crowd or whatever, yeah. Or the people who every single incident anywhere in the world do describe as a false flag. I'm not saying any of that. All I'm suggesting is real journalism, real investigation requires questions, even ones that are uncomfortable and even ones that could reflect badly on you, whatever. I think that in the interest of finding the truth, we have to ask these very important questions.
And let's look at this strategy, not a single thing
that we've raised that does not deserve investigation and an answer here.
On that point, let me raise this. Okay, first of all, if I were to walk out the door of where I am now and blow something up, and then come back, I made it back safely, and now I'm going to announce who did it. I could announce that it was ISIS. I could announce it was the Revolutionary Communist Party. I could announce it was the Boy Scouts of America, whoever. And then those are the parties that are going to feel the repercussions of that action in one fashion or another. And so whoever the actual actors are, you know, they have a choice of presenting either, you know, that this was really us or this was someone else. That's something that has to be considered, at least as a possibility. In terms of the strategy that has been employed against ISIS on the battlefield by the United States, on the one hand, that of, as we've discussed, of trying to steer ISIS this way or that, and to make sure that it can only go after, for example, the Syrian Arab Army as opposed to the quote-unquote moderate rebels, you know, positing that against the Russian strategy of killing terrorists, period. If you look at what's happened in Paris now against that kind of strategy, first you can see that the U.S. strategy failed in terms of containment and direction, unless it's their intent.
Very important, because as late as Friday, Obama was talking about that ISIS is contained. This was in the hours before the Paris attacks, never mind what happened with the Russian airliner. Obama was claiming that his policy of containment of ISIS, he completely even dropped the degradation and the, you know, eventual destruction of ISIS, and was just talking about containment, just showing the absolute bankruptcy of American policy to what, you know, has to be at least to some extent regarded as the bastard child of their actions in Syria and Iraq.
Well, I know the theory side of that, though, would be this. Maybe they were steered that way.
Maybe. Look, I know that we're running out of time here, so I want to shift the conversation, if I could, really quickly, where I think that this is all going, because within a few hours of the incident in Paris, you already heard the announcement on CNN of the French naval vessels headed towards Syria, the expansion of France's involvement.
They were already on their way there. Charles de Gaulle, it was already scheduled to leave on Wednesday and head there.
But the point is, this all coincides with François Hollande coming on camera saying that they will wage a pitiless war, etc. My point here is that the expansion, the widening of this war is really the outcome that we need to be examining and we need to be fearful of, because, of course, this poses a very real question that I mentioned when I was on a number of TV channels. Namely, this is a historical moment. This is a moment of the most critical historical importance, because this is a moment in which you could have the United States, the United Kingdom, and France unite with Russia in an international coalition to destroy this cancer in the region and in the world. However, that is the unlikely outcome here, because the far more likely outcome is that the Western powers are going to use this as a pretext for further engagement in the war to undermine Russia's efforts to actually work against what Russia is doing vis-a-vis ISIS, but also vis-a-vis Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, Islamic Army of Conquest, all of these groups. So in effect, then, the attacks on Paris are going to be used to justify a counter-Russian strategy in Syria, one that was politically unfeasible and let's call it unpalatable for Obama and Cameron and the rest of them up until about 48 hours ago.
Until this moment of political shock where suddenly the unthinkable becomes possible.
And again, well, now we have to wage war against ISIS, and we can't kowtow to Putin in doing it.
I can't imagine that France is not going to invoke Article 5 of NATO at this point.
An attack upon one is
an attack upon us all.
And let's point out the fact as we close that we still have the possibility of direct engagement between the U.S., U.K., and French forces, in other words, NATO and Russia. Syria. Okay,
apocalyptic
guys.
Scenario. An apocalyptic scenario. Strange Lovian, in its fright. And I think that we need to guard against that. And I think that those of us who are, you know, interested in trying to have some kind of peace here should also remember that all of this happened on the eve of talks in Vienna. And there was a potential that maybe something, now I'm somewhat skeptical, but regardless of that something could have come out of Vienna that could have been a working, document or, a step forward in the right direction. I think that to some degree, that's out the window now.
Yeah, it is.
And now what you have instead is the exact opposite. Rather than trying to wind down this war and moving towards some kind of a ceasefire between, whatever rebel factions were going to be represented at the table and the Syrian Arab Army, rather than that, now you're going to have an expansion of this war with the U.S., U.K., and France having all the justification they need to do everything far beyond dropping 50 tons of weapons.
Okay.
To double down on regime change.
And we're going
to
end it there. Thanks a lot. Eric Draitzer, Mark Sloboda, pleasure. We'll see you again next week.
Thanks, Don. Okay. Eric, honor and a pleasure.
Thanks, Mark.
Bye. You've been listening to CPR Sunday with Eric Draitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.